Hello, and welcome to Media Industry Conversations. I'm your host, Hannah Wold. This program is part of an ongoing speaker series at the University of Texas at Austin. It's co-sponsored by the Department of Radio, Television, Film, and the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries. This series allows students to meet and hear from industry professionals who share their experiences, knowledge, and thoughts on the rapidly changing media landscape. Thanks to RTF, CME, and our guest speakers, this podcast can now make those interviews widely accessible. This week's guest is Neil Moritz. Neil Moritz is the founder of Original Film and one of the most prolific producers in Hollywood today. After graduating from UCLA with a bachelor's in economics, Moritz earned a graduate degree from the prestigious Peter Stark Producing Program at USC. Moritz's credits include some of the best-known titles in film, including the Fast and Furious franchise, 21 and 22 Jump Street, and teen classics like I Know What You Did Last Summer and Cruel Intentions. In television, Moritz has produced such notable series as Amazon's The Boys, Fox's Prison Break, and CBS's SWAT. Neil Moritz spoke to UT students on February 6, 2023, and the conversation was hosted by RTF Associate Professor of Practice Micah Barber. They discussed his career trajectory, the scope of his work as the producer and founder of Original Film, and his views on the current state of the media industries.
Okay, welcome everybody. We're very excited to kick off this Monday morning with a special guest. I'll make a few announcements and introduce our guest. And even before we welcome him, we actually have something to watch this morning, which should be exciting. Little wrinkle. So thanks for joining us in this installment of Media Industry Conversations. So I'm Micah Barber. I know many of you, but not all of you. I'm an associate professor of practice here, a director and producer, and also the guest host for today. I want to acknowledge and thank Elisa Perrin, who unfortunately can't be here today, but she's the founder of this incredible series. And Elisa's efforts bring us world-class guests like our guest today. Very sorry she can't be here. I'd also like to thank Cindy McCreary, who's been very instrumental in this program, as well as Program Director Leslie Willard of the Center for Entertainment Media Industries, Center for Entertainment and Media Industries. Thanks to everyone in RTF, especially Alana Wakeman, and the Moody College of Communication, especially Dean Bernhardt, Keith Berner, who's here, Kathleen Mabley, and Jake Woolup, as well as Matt Gustafson from Neil Moritz's office, who's been very helpful. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, which is at RTFMIC, and check out our website for more information on upcoming speakers, as well as podcasts of sessions with previous speakers. So let me go ahead and introduce Neil, and then we'll watch a little teaser, and then we'll welcome him properly. So Neil Moritz is the founder of Original Film and one of the most prolific producers in Hollywood today. Neil has produced over 60 major motion pictures, and we can probably notch that up a few just in the last couple months, which have earned more than $11 billion at the box office worldwide. He's produced every film in the Fast and Furious franchise, including the upcoming Fast and Furious 10. His most recent release, Sonic the Hedgehog 2, debuted to $72 million domestically, and the franchise is slated for two more features as well as a TV spinoff. Additional film credits include 21 and 22 Jump Street, Goosebumps 1 and 2, and the teen classics I Know What You Did Last Summer and Cruel Intentions. Neil's television productions include Amazon's most watched series, The Boys, and SWAT for CBS. Past television credits include Preacher, Happy, and Prison Break. A Los Angeles native, Neil completed his undergraduate studies in economics at UCLA, before earning a graduate degree from the Peter Stark Producing Program at USC. Let's welcome Neil Moritz. All right, I'm guessing that some of you may have seen something that was in that reel, probably several somethings, so pretty exciting. Neil, I can't wait to be able to talk about some of the things that we've seen here, but I'm actually wondering as a starting place, if we can actually kind of go back to some of your early decisions, early choices. So when you were sitting in seats like these, you're at UCLA, studying economics, what was your first inkling of what you might be interested in doing? How did you start to figure out what you wanted to do?
I mean, when I was going to UCLA, I really didn't think I wanted to be in the movie and television industry just because I was my family had always been involved in that industry. My grandfather had was a Polish immigrant who came here, had a lot of businesses, had a couple movie theaters in downtown Los Angeles that my dad and his twin sisters kind of managed. And then he gave an usher at his theater, a guy named James Nicholson, and this other guy, Sam Arkoff, $10,000 to start a small distribution company called American International Pictures, which made all these beach party movies, the Vincent Price movies, the Billy Jack movies. They were like the genre movie making company that started everybody from Roger Corman and Martin Scorsese and James Cameron. It was a great company, but at that time, my father was in charge of marketing distribution. So at my parents' house, they had a screening room. And my brother and I had to rotate every Friday and Saturday night, running the projectors. And I hated it. It was like instead of being able to go out, I had to run it on a Friday night. My brother had to run it on a Saturday night. So I really wanted nothing to do with the movie business. So I went to UCLA, which I grew up very close to, studied economics. When I was in a junior, I went on something called Semester at Sea, where you go around the world in this boat. It was an incredible experience. We visited, 30 different countries. It was amazing. And when I was in China, and China was a very different place back then, totally communist country, where capitalism really didn't exist at all. But every kid in China carried these canvas bags with these little clasps. And I brought them back as presents. They had Chinese writing on them, and they were cool. And we brought them back, and I gave one to my girlfriend at the time, gave one to different friends of ours as kind of a gift. And people started asking, where can we get these? And me and my friend, who was my roommate on Semester at Sea, decided, you know what, we're going to start a little company trying to make and import these things. We had no idea what we were getting ourselves involved in. It wasn't very different from what I do today. And we started this company called Malibu Mercantile, where we made these bags, we brought it back here, and slowly but surely we started selling these purses. We were making them in like two different colors at the time. And 3 years later, we were selling to like every major department store. We had a variety of handbags. I can't believe that was what I was doing. But I had one of these kind of falling down the movie moments where I was driving out to this warehouse that we had in the valley across from Anheuser-Busch Beer Gardens, where you could smell beer all day long. And I walked in, and I was just like, there's no way I can do this the rest of my life. And I said, we got to figure a way out of this. And we were lucky that somebody had invested some money in the company, and they wanted to take the whole thing. So we sold the company, not for a ton of money, but for enough money that I didn't really have to worry about for the next couple of years. And that's when I decided, you know what, I think movie making and filmmaking is in my blood, and I'm going to go and apply to the Peter Stark Motion Picture Program at USC. I didn't know that much about it, but I'd heard about it a little bit, and it seemed like a prestigious place, so I applied. I got in. It was actually the first time in my life that I actually liked school, because it really was the perfect combination for me of creative and business. And I can't say that it fully prepared me to be a producer, but what I think it did was gave me a lot of knowledge about how the business of film worked. And it gave me a big leg up on all the other people that were trying to be producers. And so it was a 2-year program, great program, had a great internship at Columbia Pictures in between the 2 years, which is a whole other story. They assigned me to go to marketing as my internship, but I really didn't want to be in marketing. I wanted to be on the production side. So I just showed up at Columbia Pictures and the whole time pretend I had been assigned to the production side, and nobody ever asked me a question. So I just kept doing it. And so the program ended. I graduated. I thought coming out of this really prestigious program, it would be an easy thing to get a job. But it was 1985-ish or so. There was really no jobs available to the industry. The industry was going through some tumultuous times. There was a lot of cutbacks, and there was no jobs available. So I was like, what am I going to do? And I just decided I'm going to hang on my shingle and try and be a producer. And like I said earlier to some of you guys, is like, it's really hard to say you're a producer if you haven't produced anything. So it was kind of just keeping up this illusion and convincing people that even though I hadn't produced anything yet, I was a producer. And so my tact was to try and find young writers, people that are in this room today, that hadn't achieved success yet, but I thought had talent, try and marry them with what I thought I had, very commercial ideas, with their writing talents, and develop screenplays that then I could control, and that the only way that that material would ultimately get made was if I could be the producer on it. So that was my tact. And I don't know if I knew that much at the time to really think that that was a great tact, but that was my tact at the time.
That's great. And I remember you also, I've heard you say that probably the best thing that you did at this time was pay attention to the people around you. And
yeah.
It sounds like that was really instrumental and maybe advice that you'd like to impart here too.
Yeah, I think, sure, would it be great to have a relationship with me because I have access to talent and money and so on? Yes. But in the long run, I think the smartest thing that you all could do is create strong relationships with other like-minded people who go to either this university who are interested in film and TV or other universities interested in film and TV, and develop those relationships, because those long-standing relationships are going to be the things that help you the most in a long-term career. All the people that I deal with now who are the heads of studios or heads of agencies or whatever are people that I've known for long time. So it makes doing business with them, there's already a trust and foundations built that allow us to do business very easily. So yes, sure, develop as many relationships as you can, but the key ones are the ones amongst your peers here.
So for you, when you were getting started, and calling yourself a producer, yeah, looking for writers, looking for material, what do you think a couple of the real smart things that you did, or a person that you met, or a break that now looking back, you're like, wow, that was really a break
for
me?
There were two or three writers that I developed multiple projects with that, you know, back then there was a really thriving, what we would call a spec market. Like, you know, we'd work on a screenplay together, and then, like, you'd call up all the studios on one day and say, okay, we've got this hot script. And it was like this feeding frenzy. If you had something that people wanted, it was like things happened really, really quickly. So I was lucky in that I probably developed three or four of those things that got bought in this kind of bidding frenzy. Now, the weird part is those didn't actually get made. But what it did was it got my name out there, and younger studio executives at the major studios were saying, who is this guy that's being able to develop develop these screenplays and sell these screenplays for a lot of money? And then I was able to get my first deal. Paramount Pictures came to me and said, we want to offer you an overall deal, which all it was it was a great thing. It wasn't like they were paying me money. They were just giving me an office on the lot. They were giving me an assistant. My assistant was making more money than I was, but it gave me the credibility that here I was, a producer of Paramount Pictures.
So I guess also at that time, who did you kind of consider a key collaborator or collaborators? How did you start to kind of build things a little bit?
Well, the young writers that I was developing screenplays with, for sure, the young agents who then I was, like, most of these writers weren't even represented. So I was at being able to feed young, talented writers to agents, young executives at the studios who were looking to make their name were then kind of aligning with me, and they were developing relationships with me, with those younger agents, and with those younger writers. And so those are the people we kind of have risen together with. And I remember I was having a garage sale at my first house, and, you know, it was selling a bunch of junk. But on one table, there was a pile of screenplays, because back in the day, like now, I don't have any screenplays because they're all on my iPad. I read everything on it. But back then, like, your house would get so cluttered with screenplays, and I had a bunch of these screenplays. They were sitting on a table. They weren't actually for sale. they were just, when I was cleaning out stuff to put on the lawn, they happened to be there. And this young guy came up to me named Randy McCormick, and he said, "Can I buy those?" And I was like, well, I was just throwing away, but sure, a dollar a piece or whatever it was. And he became one of these guys. I think we sold like three big screenplays in a row. One was this thing called The Northmen, which was a big epic kind of Viking tale. One was called First Murder in Space. You know, it was that he wrote these screenplays for me. I didn't pay him anything. And we just kind of would form these joint ventures each time. And he made a lot, he did very well on it. But more importantly, he got his name out there. And he became like a top screenwriter in Hollywood for, you know, 10 years. So so I was looking for writers anywhere. I mean, I was trying to convince people to write screenplays for me for free. And the thing that I had, I was giving them what I thought was very commercial ideas. So I thought there were very talented writers, but they didn't necessarily have the most commercial ideas. And if I could marry the two and form these joint ventures, it would be good for them and be good for me.
That actually leads into a question that I wanted to ask you, which is, what did you consider in your early days your market advantage? What did you have? What were you doing? Was it work? Was it how were you getting ahead of the curve in your early days?
I think I had very good commercial instincts, and I think that had been kind of ingrained in me from a very young age, because at my father's company, grandfather's company, they wouldn't make a movie unless they could make the poster first. The poster dictated everything. If they could, and so, and the way I would look at it is, if I couldn't make a trailer for a movie in my head, like first, then I probably wouldn't make that movie. Because as I was saying earlier, like, there's so much content. Even today, there's way more content than when I first started. But back then, you know, they were releasing 2, 3, 4 movies every weekend. So if you didn't have something that could cut through that clutter and could grab eyeballs, you were starting at a big disadvantage. So personally, I would rather have a movie with a fantastic commercial idea with average execution than a movie with not a very good idea with great execution. I mean, I'd like to have both, but if I had to pick, I would definitely pick something that had a much bigger commercial hook to it, because at least I could get people to the movie theater. You know, there's a big difference between, sure, you do a test screening for a movie and it tests, you know, huge. But if you can't get people into the theater to watch that great movie, you got a big problem. So it's about, how do you get people in?
So that actually also leads very well into kind of moving us a little closer to present day. So flash forward, and you know, you've made 60 or 70 movies. You've done over $11 billion at the box office, television business, all of it. How has what's your evolution been in what you're looking for? What makes a bullseye for you? I've heard you talk about concept quite a bit. And also, I'm particularly interested in just hearing how your development. So at Original Film, when you're looking through projects, when you're being pitched constantly, right? How do you sort of figure out, yes, this one, not these 50?
Well, I mean, when I first started, I would have made anything just to try and get something made. I mean, literally, like, anything that I could get somebody to say yes to, I would have made. Like, because I needed the validity of the fact that I had actually produced something, okay? So as I've become more successful in my career, what I want to make has changed, because now, really, I really only want to make things that I really think can be successful. It's too hard and too difficult to make, whether it's movies or TV shows today, it's so hard to get these things made that if I'm going to spend all this time and all this effort, I really want to get a lot of eyeballs on to it. So that's changed. I'd like to make movies at higher budgets, because I'm trying to make things for worldwide audiences. And I think that there's certain things that with money I can produce that, you know, make things want to see movies in every territory around the world. It's very hard to make a domestic comedy that I can make cheaper than a big action film play in every country around the world. Action, these kind of big visual effects, fantasy kind of stuff requires a lot of money, unfortunately. So, and if I'm going to put the effort in, I really want things to play worldwide.
That also leads us perfectly into something that I know we're excited to talk about, which is the Fast and Furious franchise. I mean, really, it would be hard not to argue that that's the most successful franchise globally. It's dominated the last 20 years. Stepping back just a minute.
I never thought, even when we were making the first one or even after the success of the first one, I never thought we would be making 10.
I was going to ask about that. When you were in, so actually even the question I had jotted down is that building a franchise is incredibly difficult, and everyone is trying to do it currently. But back in the late 90s, when you were starting to develop this concept, this idea, how did that come together? And then also I'm very curious, because you were very ahead of the curve on what actually will play internationally. And also, particularly having a multicultural cast was became a value of that.
Probably in 2001 when we made that movie. Actually, I would say that studios would have argued that a multicultural cast would probably have been a detriment in the worldwide box office at the time. That's not what it is today. But I felt like, look, I love making movies about subcultures, about going into worlds that people feel like they know a little bit about, or I'm interested in a little bit, but as you get deeper into it, you learn more about it. There's a wish fulfillment aspect to it that I really, really like. But if we would have made Fast and Furious and it wouldn't have been a multicultural cast, it wouldn't have been successful because it wouldn't have been real. Okay, when we read this article about the underground street racing world, we visited those meets and stuff to understand what it was, and all you had to do was look around and realize that it was. Everybody has a love of their first car. Doesn't matter of what ethnic background you are. I think that's a common thing. And when we were going out there, we were seeing there were no color barriers. I mean, it was just open to everybody. And so when we went to cast the movie, it wasn't like we were saying, oh, we need a this and a this and a this. It was just like what felt natural and real to that world. And I think there, after we did that, there was a lot of movies made where they did cast the movies away, where it was like, okay, we have to put one of this, which didn't make those movies feel real. And it was like, it felt like it was manufactured, and that's not what we were trying to do. We were just trying to emulate what was really going on out in that specific world. Now, even when we made that movie, and I don't know, Universal probably made 15 movies that year. It was by far the cheapest movie that Universal had made that year. It was a very under-the-radar movie. Nobody was expecting it to become what it came. Where I knew kind of that we were on to something was the first time we ever screened the movie, and the audience really, really liked the movie, and the test scores were great. But when I walked out of the theater into the parking lot, and you saw kids in their cars doing donuts around the parking lot and rice, that's when we knew we kind of had something special. And it wasn't called Fast and Furious then.
Yeah, tell us that story. I actually read that story, and I saw that Roger Corman comes into play in that story as well.
Yeah, Roger Corman, who's probably the greatest B filmmaker of all time. He's like an idol of mine. He's an amazing guy. His office is actually just down the street from me, and a really nice guy. But when we were making the movie, it was called Red Line, it was called Race Wars, it was called a bunch of terrible titles. And I went with my father to see a documentary on the company American National Pictures. And I'm watching that documentary, and they were talking about Roger Corman, and I remember leaning over to I said, I need like a title for this movie, like a Roger Corman kind of title. And he had made a movie called Fast and Furious. Now, Fast and Furious today sounds so natural, but at that time, Fast and Furious sounded really terrible, the title. But I remember leaving that screening of that movie, and I was like, God, maybe that would be a great title for this movie. I called up the president of Universal, and I said, you know what? I think we should rename the movie from Red Line to Fast and Furious. And there was silence on the other end. He probably thought it was a terrible idea, and I was almost embarrassed to say it, to be honest. But he called me back the next morning, and he says, you know what? It's kind of stuck with me. And I said, well, let me call Roger. I called up Roger Corman, and I said, Roger, I want to buy the rights to that title from you. And he's like, you give me stock footage from some movies, and I'll give you the title. So we gave him some stock footage of, like, you know, just aerial shots, bullshit. And he gave us the title. And that was it. That's how we got the title.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it was crazy.
You know, sticking with Fast and Furious, another thing that I'd love to hear from you is, you know, the longevity of that franchise, but you've had to reinvent yourselves, and you've had to refresh it, and it seems to me that you've had a particular eye for audience, and we mentioned international as well, but what has that evolution been like for you, producing something that has had that longevity? How do you think about it?
Well, producing movies or television are like pushing a ball uphill and everybody else is trying to push the ball downhill, okay? That's what it is. And if you don't like hearing the word no, producing is not the right job for you. I mean, honestly, it's truly, even at this point in my career, I hear no way more than I hear yes, way more. So I always have just kind of thought about that, how am I going to deal with being rejected all the time? And somebody gave me, I think it was Larry Gordon, who was a great old producer, kind of mentor of mine. I think it was him who told me is that the way when you walk into a room or a Zoom or however you sell things nowadays, when you're pitching, that you go in with the framework in your mind that you are presenting an opportunity to them. If they don't take the opportunity, it's their loss, not yours. And I think that stuck with me from day one. So in terms of Fast and Furious, which even on number 10, we're pushing the ball uphill because we're always trying to reinvent ourselves, is how do we push that ball uphill and try and kind of level the field? So with Fast and Furious, what we've tried to do is each time is give them enough of something from the previous films, some feeling from the previous films that they can relate to and have nostalgia and come back to Fast and Furious because that's what they want. But each time, try and give them something a little new. And I think Fast and Furious 5, where we introduced The Rock and turned it kind of just from kind of a street racing movie into a big kind of action heist movie, that was the biggest change of the franchise that turned it from like a smaller street racing action movie to a worldwide event. And that was really kind of the turning point from that franchise. And, you know, I think that we have gone a little bit astray in like Fast 9 when we, you know, go off into space, which we were talking earlier. That one had always been a joke to us that, like, we knew we had jumped the shark when we went to space. And then of course, we go to space. So that was, like, a stupid idea. But I think what we're trying to do in Fast 10, and if we do movies in the future with that, is to kind of bring it back to what it once was, to evolve it and then start to bring it back. So that's what I'm hoping what we've done in this movie. I think this movie's really good, Fast 10, and I'm really proud of what we've done. And we're trying to do something different than we've ever done in the past, but like I said, give the audience enough of what they've been accustomed to and what they like.
So can you talk about also, you know, there's a difference between Cruel Intentions and I Know What You Did Last Summer and Fast Five, right? What was your, what sort of journey did you have to go on as a producer? And I'm also just interested in kind of like pulling the audience in that way too, because, you know, they're thinking about their career and, you know, next year when they graduate, they're not going to go make Fast Five.
Yeah, well, right? Nobody was going to give me $100 million or $200 million or $300 million at the beginning of my career to make these movies. So I was like, how am I going to get movies made? I'm going to make, okay, Here was my kind of thought process. What is going to be my thing? And my thing was, I'm going to try and make movies at the beginning of my career for young people with movies that don't require huge budgets. And I was thinking, okay, back then, on the weekends, older people who had worked, 5 days a week, hard 9-to-5 type jobs, they were less apt to go out on the weekends because they were tired and they worked hard, okay? Whereas kids wanted to go out. They wanted to be amongst other kids. They wanted to be at the malls. So why don't I try and make movies for an audience that wants to go out versus having to try and drag people out? So I was like, I'm going to make movies about young people, for young people, that I can make at cheaper budgets. And that's how I started. And I remember this guy, Jeff Blake, who was the best distribution guy in the business and somebody I idolized, always said young beats old. And kind of a big turning point in my career was there was this movie called Devil's Advocate with Keanu Reeves, I think Al Pacino, I think Charlize Theron coming out, and it came out the same weekend as I Know What You Did Last Summer. And I was like, wow, we're going to get killed. And he's like, nope, young beats old. And the movie opened, and I Know What You Did Last Summer beats Devil's Advocate. Like, in Devil's Advocate, it had some of the biggest stars in the business then, and we had all these, no-name kids. They were kind of known from, TV shows, Buffy and so on. And we beat them, and that was, a real turning point. And that was something Hollywood really kind of woke up to, that these younger starring pictures could do big business. So that allowed me then to kind of move up the chain and start to make movies with a little bigger budgets. But I did it out of necessity. I mean, it was like I was looking for, what could be my inroads into the business? What would they allow me to make? What could I pretend like I was an expert on that other people weren't? And so after that, people thought, oh, he knows how to make movie and capture what the younger people want. So then all of a sudden studios were letting me do these other kinds of movies. But I think if I look at kind of the catalog of my movies, and yes, Cruel Intentions and Sweet Home Alabama is very different than Jump Street and Fast and Furious and Sonic. They're all very different genres, but I do think they have one common thread, which is they are big mainstream entertainment. And it doesn't mean they had to be entertainment for everybody. As long as I could, I would rather have a movie that has real heat within one demographic than lukewarm heat amongst every demographic. And that's what I did when I first started, a movie that I made called Juice with Tupac Shakur before he was Tupac. I knew we were making that movie, and I knew we had one demographic that really was dying to see that movie. And then I was trying to broaden it out. Now can I get two demographics, three quadrants, four quadrants?
So let's talk about four quadrants, and let's talk about young beats old. Yep. Sonic the Hedgehog,
yep.
Right? So tell us about Sonic and how the story of how the development for that went. Yep. And
one of the worst days in my career.
Yeah, and I know you're a big gamer as well.
No,
right?
I've never played a video game in my life. I hate video games. It's just not my thing. I'd rather be outside playing sports or whatever. I just couldn't understand video games. I just did not have the attention span to play video games. I don't know. I just couldn't do it. A young guy who works in my office, Toby Asher, who's a producer on the movie with me, loved video games. He was the opposite of me. He came to me with Sonic the Hedgehog. I really knew nothing about Sonic the Hedgehog. I knew the name, but I knew it was this blue hedgehog. And I started to look about, the cemetery of video game movies. Video games had turned into movies, and none of them had really worked. And I started to look at why they hadn't worked. And they were never really about a main character. They were about worlds or, first-person shooter or this or that. And I thought what was interesting about Sonic, at least there was a main character at the center of it that I could even like. I liked that character. So I said, okay, let's try it. And I tried to take the point of view of trying to make a movie about a character for people that weren't interested in video games, whereas he was making a movie for people that love video games. So I think the integration of those two points of view was the thing that it made, that allowed us to make a movie, Sonic the Hedgehog, that people who love video games loved, and people who didn't like video games could appreciate as well. And that was kind of a great dynamic. Even though, and we had, you know, I had mentioned earlier, we had a lot of Sonic super fans that we had involved in the movie who were always giving us their opinions, and we tried to make a movie that they could love, but other people who didn't know anything about Sonic could love as well. So we went to go make the movie. We went to make the movie, and we had a great director who was a huge Sonic fan. But his idea was to make Sonic look more realistic. Realistic to a hedgehog, but realistic. And, you know, I was like, okay, that sounds like a good idea, not understanding the beloved nature of Sonic, exactly how he existed. So we were off making this movie, and I really do like to try and keep a macro view, kind of a 10,000 feet view of the movies, but I got very micro on that movie. And as we were changing the character of Sonic inch by inch, a little bit farther and farther and farther from his video game look, I didn't really see it as a problem. So we think we've made this great movie. We're in the middle of making this great movie. We put out the trailer for the movie, and I've never had a trailer that has had more reaction in my life. The good news was it was seen by more people than any trailer that Paramount had ever released in their history. The bad news was probably 90% of the people hated, not the trailer, but they hated how he looked. And I was like, oh my God, we have made the biggest flop. Why did I get involved in some video game movie? I knew I shouldn't have.
So just to pause there.
It was terrible.
Just for a moment, at the pause and the drama of this, right? I mean, this, you guys all saw it, right? This is a big deal. Raise your hand if you saw that trailer, saw that news, right? And so what would have happened...
We trended everywhere, yes, but not in a good way.
In 95% of cases, what would have happened is the studio says, well, we got a stinker, let's overmarket this and pump it out and try and recoup in our first weekend or two and before people really hate it. And so this is a true unicorn success story. Tell us what happened.
So myself, Toby works with me, and the director, we knew, oh boy, we got a problem here. So I called up the head of Paramount, who I had convinced to make this movie. He knew less about video games than I did, but I had convinced him to make this movie. And I said, here's the good news, here's the bad news. Can we all get together tomorrow at 9 a.m.? And I knew I was walking into kind of a firing squad. It was all the Paramount executives, all the Sega executives. And we mapped out a plan where we said, okay, we need $13 million. We need to push back the movie. I can't remember if it was 6 months or what exact the time frame was. And here's what we're going to do. And we had overnight taken the main character that was in that trailer, redesigned him to be much, much closer to the design of the video game. We had one frame of it done. We put it up and said, this is what we need to do. And I give them a lot of credit. The head of marketing stood up and said, listen, we never get this much reaction to trailer. The good news, like I said, is, you know, it's been seen by, I don't know, 100 million people. The bad news, but if we can turn that around and we can make the fans feel like for the first time in the history of Hollywood that they've actually been listened to, we can spin this. So that's what we did. We didn't show anybody anything for, I don't know, 3-4 months. We redid the trailer with the new Sonic. It went out. And as bad as the last reaction was in the first trailer, that's how good was the reaction was to this trailer. And it just turned. And we knew we were going to have a hit. And we did. And that's how it happened. So I was going to say, it was like turning lemons into lemonade. But, like, you can only imagine when we released that second trailer with the thing changed and we'd spent all this money. It was the most nerve-wracking day. Like, are they going to embrace it? And thank God they did.
I was going to ask, when did you first sleep during that period?
No, it was like, okay, I think we released the trailer. I don't know. We usually release a trailer like on Monday at like 3 o'clock or whatever it was. And we hit the button, it goes out, and at like 3:10, we started to see the comments come in, and we were like, yeah. It was amazing. It was an amazing experience.
So I have a couple more questions, but be thinking of questions that you'd like to ask Neil. We'll have about 20 minutes or so at the end, and so please be thinking of questions for Neil that you'd like to ask. Couple last ones that I'd like to pick your brain on. This is a little more general, but what surprised you about the film and television industry or business? What surprised you, I guess, during your career? And then maybe what surprises you today? What stands out to you?
I think the good thing about the industry is there's no barrier to entry. I don't know of a script. I really don't know of a script that should it be made that hasn't been made. It's like we are out there, people like myself and all my peers, we are scrounging through anything to try and find what can be the next movie. So it's very, look, there's obviously certain times, I'm sure, that movies haven't got made that should get made, but I think it's very rare. And I think the good thing is that anybody with talent today will make it in this business, because we are, I mean, there's so much content being made. Everybody is looking for who that next person, next screenplay, next star, next director, anything can be made. I think it's an incredibly tough industry, but I think if you've got the talent and you can hang in there, you can make it. But you got to hang in there because it's not easy. That is for sure, and it probably hasn't gotten easier. But because you can go out and make a movie for so cheap today, and you can show your talent, I think that you can make it. But it's not easy. It's hard, and it's very stressful. And like I said, you hear no more than you hear yes, and you just got to keep pushing, for sure.
Will you speak just for a moment along those lines about concept and character? I've heard you say a couple really fascinating things today about those two.
Okay. Well, first of all, here's the good news. Anybody here can be a producer. Anybody can. If you have something that people want to make. Okay, this bottle of water, if this is the best bottle of water ever, and there's three studios that want to turn this bottle of water or two into a movie, and they desperately want to make this into a movie, if you control this bottle of water, and the only way they get to make this movie is you say, I'm the producer of that movie, will be a producer. It's that clear. You need to control something, though. You need to have something, whether it's an idea, a book, a script, a play, an original idea, something that you have that people want to make, you can be a producer. So that's what I would say is, find that thing. Find that piece of talent. Find something, and then you can be a producer. And what was the other thing?
Oh, just concept and character.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think that, look, the action is very expensive to make in a movie. Visual effects are very expensive to make in a movie. Fantasy, supernatural is very expensive to make in a movie. But what's not expensive is a great character, a character that a lot of people can relate to, want to go on that journey with. That's cheap. So, like, if you can marry great concept with great character, that's the recipe for hit movie, hit TV show, hit whatever.
So my final question before we turn it over to the room is how it's back to students here. And so, you know, how do you, if you were in their shoes right now, 2023, just starting to enter their careers, how would you be thinking about the industry, thinking about entry points? What advice would you give them about what to do? It could be even while they're here at UT, or it could be in their first couple steps.
Well, I mean, like I said, while you're here, meet and work on and explore as many things that you can possibly do. I think that the advice that I would give somebody to coming to Hollywood today is I'd go to LA, and if I had my choice, I would go work at an agency. It doesn't mean you have to be an agent or want to be an agent. I just think that the agencies are the nexus where everything goes through. Everything passes through them, whether it's the screenplay or acting or financing or whatever. I just go try and go work in the, whether it's the mailroom or on somebody's desk at any agency in Hollywood, and try and get a little understanding of how the business really works, who the players are, and what the things are that are getting made. Unless you just have such a great, unique talent that you can just go write a screenplay or direct a film or short. Look, if you're a great director and you can make a great short film and you have that as a calling card, you can be a director in Hollywood very easily. If you can write a screenplay that's a great screenplay, you can have a great career in Hollywood as a screenwriter right away. So if you have those kinds of talents or an actor, that's a different story than if you wanted to be a producer or an executive or something else in the business.
Okay. Let's thank Neil for being here today.
Thank you for listening to Media Industry Conversations. This has been a co-production of the Department of Radio, Television, Film and the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries in the Moody College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit rtf.utexas.edu/mic and follow the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries on LinkedIn and Instagram. This series was made possible by the work of Dr. Elisa Perrin and Cindy McCreary with the assistance of Keith Berner, Christina Bruning, Laura Brown, Paxton Haven, and Maggie McGinnis. This program was co-produced and edited by Sophia Abbey and me, Hannah Wold. We hope you join us next time for another Media Industry Conversation.